sitting here about time. About the measurements of years, days, months, etc. Specifically, it's about the word moment and what it implies. Moment is the common word for the shortest division of time and implies movement, mass. It seems to be true that all material is constantly in a state of change, from create, to decay. This is an example of a good bit of phonetic thinking and shows how thinking phonetically can help to solve things that would otherwise be problematic. Can-tie-m-t-i-e M be seen as a binding factor in the constantly changing rotation rate? We said on other occasions that this T letter signifies a crossing where the two lines represent forces travelling at right angles to each other. We do find an old symbol made of three T's, which is related to the one in the other man, and we find one in heraldry made of four T's, called a cross potent, where it is said that the T's are crutches. And if you know something of the tradition about the devil going about on crutches, and the time process itself being a crippling process on eternal power, these things can be tied together. We pronounce M with the lips closed and say that M equals substance, because when we circumscribe a force, we bring into being the possibility of an individual standing on the perimeter of that rotation and defining that below his feet as substantia, that which is underneath his standing. That would then be equivalent to substance. TM would then mean the crossing of forces in a closed system or time. So we have here a statement about key, create, and DK. T and K are very closely related. If we imagine a wall and then a force hitting that wall, we have the significance of the letter K, where K equals kick and keep. Now in T we don't bother about the idea of keeping the forces together. We just allow that one force and another force are propagating at right angles to each other. If we draw a circle, let the perimeter stand for the top of the T, any radius in it is a force going from the centre to the perimeter, and that would mean the tying of the perimeter to the centre. But we would not be concerned with keeping it there. If we imagine the hand of a clock to go round in various moments of time, it is describing T throughout that substance, that is T and N, that is, it is describing time. But if we want to keep it in one place, then we must not allow it to rotate, we must nail it together, and then we use the letter K to symbolize it. When we put K and T together, as in the Greek prefix ket, as in catalepsy and so on, we find a symbol meaning fixity, and the symbol meaning the passing of forces across each other, and therefore the fixation of forces crossing each other. the animal called the cat is so called because its motions are all staccato. You notice that the cat concentrates on whatever it's doing from moment to moment, and as soon as the cat has exhausted the meaning of a given phenomenon, it turns away from that one to another one. It never turns gradually from one percept to another. You find its behaviour is quite other than the behaviour of a dog in this respect, because a dog allows its attention to go over a lot of people, one after the other, in a continuous change of direction. But the cat doesn't do that. The cat always switches its attention suddenly. It hears a bird outside, it turns the whole of its attention on the bird. It may hear a rustling of paper in the room, it forgets the bird and turns on to the paper. It's because of this activity that it is called a cat. So if we talk about time, we're talking about the passing of radial forces along the perimeter. And if we're talking about the keeping of time, we're talking about the whole confining process. In the word take, which is the reverse of this, you have a fundamental idea to do with time, because the suggestion is there is a crossing of forces onto an already fixed situation. Now, when we consider the word moment, we are considering a root men, meaning to count, to evaluate, and a word mo, meaning substantial zone, or zone of substance, and the passing of force. Now this moment implies that there is a crossing of forces being counted in a zone of substance. If we put a V in between it, and the phonetic E asks it to pronounce it, this V means to develop. So if we take a moment and develop it, it must always go into another moment. Let's look at the clock for a moment and consider that when the hand of the clock moves, we are led to believe that it moves continuously only if we don't examine its actual motion. If we put the motion under a microscope, we will find that it's vibrating. We know in fact that it's being driven by little cogwheels, and each little wheel gives it a kick. We actually find that finger going round the clock ticking. And each one of these little ticks we would call a moment. We get a similar idea in the turning moments that architects have to study. And if we apply a force at right angles to the radius, and thus push the hand of the clock one point, the amount of energy needed to push it that fundamental distance we could call a moment, and that would coincide roughly with the meaning given to it by engineers and architects. If we take a lever and we drill a hole in its middle, suspend it on that point so that it's in perfect equilibrium, and then we put on it a little weight, very tiny weight, and that weight isn't heavy enough to overcome the friction on the point of suspension, then the lever will not move. But if we increase the weight so that it's heavy enough to overcome the friction, then it will begin to move. And we say it begins to move in a moment, which means that the substance in the situation in which those forces are crossing has now caused an appreciable difference, a phenomenal difference, one that the sense organ can perceive. So when we're applying a force, by weight or directly, by pressure, a definite amount of force is required to overcome a definite amount of resistance, and that amount of force we could call a moment. and the concept of a turning moment is related to this one. We have similar things in architecture, because we have to build very often with beams, and they act as if they were levers. If we support a beam at a certain point and then put a great weight on the projecting part of the beam and keep piling it on, eventually the beam will tilt. And at the moment it begins to tilt, we have evidence of the force being sufficient to overcome all the counterbalancing forces on the other side. And when we're talking about time, we are talking not abstractly, in real terms we are talking about substance doing something, that is forces crossing in such a way that we can actually count them. If we couldn't count them, we could not talk about moments or about movement. The fact that the M-E-N occurs in the word tells you that we're dealing with counting processes. If we took a continuous line with no vibration in it at all, actually there isn't such a line, but if we pretend for a moment there is one, we call that an abstract line. It is continuous and infinite, goes right off the paper in both directions forever. We could not count it. It would be an infinite continuous line, and consequently not countable. We couldn't even call it one line, because we would not be able to find the ends of it if it were infinite. So we would have to call it a not two line. The concept of non-dualism would be evoked. But if we allow this line to vibrate or to ripple, then we can count the wave crests and the troughs, if we wish, in between the crests. So in order to count at all, we must produce a difference. And difference is, this dip is the same as duality, and this fair, whether it's fair from bear or fakire to do, implies the same thing. It is doing or bearing to. And if it isn't doing or bearing to, then it cannot be counted. There must be a difference between the trough and the crest in the altitude before we can begin to count. Now, when we're dealing with visual space, we are dealing with a very abstract concept, because we are doing something as adults that the baby does not do. We tend as adults to define space as that which is between bodies. The bodies, material bodies, are more important to materialistic people than the space between. Space is only thought of in general by materialists as something in which to store bodies. And the space is infinite and the bodies are finite. The bodies are circumscribable and therefore locatable. You can get your hands on them. They are visual and they are tangible experiences. All the space in between is of no use to a materialist, except in so far as he can use it for storing material bodies. This is an adult way of thinking of things, because the adult has been directed to the secondary kind of activity of a living being, namely the preservation of its life through acquiring commodities, food, shelter and so on. But before the adult has been stressed on the object as a second need, his first need is immediate self-preservation, like fight or flight. The second need is a job, to get yourself some matter to eat. Before this stress is placed upon the being, in a newborn baby, we find experimentally, and we can see it quite easily with a new baby, that the baby does not focus on material objects as such. It has no concept of material values and of space as separate. from those bodies. The child, therefore, when you watch it, a newly born child, is rather alarming because its eyes don't focus on objects, they don't focus on mother or father, and they don't focus on any tangible, and they roam about quite independently initially, to the bewilderment of new mothers who've not seen it done before. And the child seems to pay as much attention to space as it does to bodies. And as this is a prime experience of a child, we have to consider it as valid at its own level. Now, you often notice that cats and dogs, cats more often than dogs, look into space and then suddenly jump out of the way as if there was something there. And therefore they've got a reputation for being a bit queer because of it. Now, we tend to think that space has nothing in it. And really we mean nothing important for us at the moment. We are so used to focusing on the object, and we have developed an eye to enable us to do that, that we ignore space as a determinant, except as a storage zone for materials. And if we actually look between objects instead of at them, we discover that we get visual sensations that we don't get if we look at the object. We can do it now, we can do it immediately in this room if you like to do. If you look, say, 4 or 5 feet away in the air, you will become very quickly conscious of motion in the air. You may think it's motion of dust particles. Of course, there are dust particles there. You wouldn't normally notice them. But if we get a perfectly dust-free room and you repeat the experiment, you will find you will still get visual sensations from the space. And you will also begin to see little lights running about in space. One investigator has related these little lights, which he calls photons, which means little lights, to the biological forces of sex. And he's not wrong in so relating them, because light itself is life. The light and the life are two different aspects of a prime force. Now, in the last part of this question, can time be seen as a binding factor in the constantly changing rotation rate? Here, the questioner has seen that time is an anagram of time M. It is also an anagram of MITE, the small. And this might, the littlest thing, is the same concept as the least time division. If we don't circumscribe a zone, and thus substantiate, if we don't tie M, we cannot generate tie me, which is the observer. We can only focus where there is an actual rotation of force. But that force, in order to be rotating at all, and in order to be tied, must be, in principle, an untiable force, which somehow has got tied. So if we draw a line for the tied force, and then say, why bother to tie it? We'll draw the line extended, without tying it. We then have the idea of a translating force. Translating force is one that keeps laying itself across space instead of localizing itself in a zone which prior to its rotation and localization didn't exist. You notice in Norse mythology the devil is named Loki. Now Loki is exactly the same as the location that you get in the Latin. It is the finiting principle. To be tied to a locus, to a place, is automatically to be finited. There are two ways of expressing the same concept. We can see then that when there is a tied substance, we have a tied process, and for any observer, a tying of me, me being the objective form, of which the subjective is I. So if we take I, that's our breath of the I, and we take the concept of me, me is the object. This letter I is a translating force. That letter I, translating, goes along and then turns itself around and makes itself into me. This means that there is no separate me from an I. Wherever there's a me, there is necessarily an I to perceive it. And what that I is perceiving, it's simply itself, finiting itself by circumscribing itself. This is the meaning of absolute subjectivity. And states that absolute consciousness, which is spirit, objectifies nothing other than itself. And the only way it can objectify is by circumscribing itself. This means that the limitation imposed on ourselves as body, you say my body, or a child says me when he falls over and bangs himself, this limitation imposed is a self-limitation by consciousness. An I has rotated some force within itself. We might think that this is rather a strange thing to do and doubt our capacity to do it. But we know that we can do it, because if we look around the room and choose to look at a given person, first of all we experience a sense of going out, that is a translating force in consciousness, and when it comes to the object, then it runs round, circumscribes the object. This is a fact of our experience. We get the eye, and the eye attention goes out, and then it goes round the person it's looking at. And as long as your attention is on the person, there is a force going round either the whole or a portion of that being. And if that force were to stop for a moment from going round, you would become unconscious of the object. We have a simple demonstration of a translating force, an I, becoming a me by simply rotating. And that tells us how to get out of me, the object, which is both accusative and dative grammatically. You can hit it, or you can give it things, according to whether you're accusing it or treating it datively. In order to get out of that me, all you have to do is stop circumscribing, stop defining. Let's look at another word, the word statement. When we are talking, if we are not careful, we will be making statements. And a statement is a counting of forces crossing each other statically. And this tat, which is good German for deed, with an O in it, is good German for death. To say we're dead. To sound shift from D's to T's. So a state is static. And as such, is an illegitimate locus being treated as if it had validity from itself. So any statement that we may make is necessarily static and therefore false. Now if I made a statement when I said any statement is necessarily static and therefore false, that would be false too, if it were a statement. But we have to examine it very carefully to see whether I did actually say anything static. And in fact, the implications are not static. To the contrary, they are an undoing of the static. If we say that this S is the undulation of spirit, and then we put the T on it, like Moses did with the serpent in the desert, to which Christ refers, we take this undulating motion and we put a T on it, then we take the flux of spirit, the flux of life, and by crucifixion, by towing it, we fix it. In the act of fixing it, we have allowed it to come into a state. That is to say, we have made it static. And for a moment, that is for a crossing force accountable in a closed zone, we have an object of attention. Imagine the absolute undulation, going about anywhere and nowhere, and then deciding a pedal with that, we'll rotate a bit, and then we'll cross inside the rotation, and we'll use this cross as the basis. That is another form of the letter T. Now, in the fact of rotating, we have brought to B, that's the letter B, a zone. Zone means zealous unification, actually. The power is zealously going round and making a one in that place. It is a locus because we have tied L, K, kept in and established that power. Prior to a rotation, there is absolutely no location whatever in infinity. And when we were talking about the way an adult sees space as that in which we store commodities when we're in business, he said it was really an abstract idea and that the baby doesn't do it. The baby is just as much aware of the space between as it is of the bodies. And it isn't until, by extension of the hand, that it finds a resistance in the hand, correspondent with certain visual sensations, that it develops the idea that there are resistant objects, which later it will learn to call material objects, and some non-resistant at the tangible level called space. But the child knows, like the cat knows, and the pigeon knows, and everybody else in the instinctual level knows, that space is every bit as important as bodies once its proper function is realized. Supposing we do a painting now, or a drawing. There is a rule in painting that if we do a little condensed or concentrated mass of color or tone, very small one in one corner, we can balance it with a large mass, not so intense, of another tone. Now, when we look at this picture, we found a very intense spot and the same amount of blackness spread over a larger area in the diagonal opposite corner, and we can see that our attention keeps moving across it. But the eye is tied to the visual sensation, the dark tone here and the grey one lighter here, and it tends to skip across the space as of no moment, that is, as not causing any turn or orientation. The orientation at the visual level of the adult, not the child, is towards the material object, and therefore the eye runs from this spot across space very quickly to the far corner of that grey mass and here, and then rotates around it and measures it. Now, in the visual arts and painting and architecture and so on, we talk about organizing space by means of form. Very simply, if I draw a curved arrow in one corner and then carry the curve right through and put a dot far away from it, although I have not actually drawn a line there, because the curve has a certain amount of inertia in it, it is doing what we call pointing at that dot, and the attention then goes across there, and we can show that we can produce almost a visual hallucination by doing this in a slightly more complex way. If I start to draw the profile of a man like this, I go down, I don't touch the paper on the forehead, and I build it up from below with tones. You will begin to see, if you're not careful, connecting lines where none exists. I want to show this vector quality like the arrow. If I draw very carefully now the edge of this shape and make that shape point to where the eyebrow goes, I now pointing across that space, you can't help feeling at that moment that that forehead is straight. If you look at it carelessly and then you're asked to say what you've seen, you would actually believe that you had seen such a thing. If we wanted to make the space in between there not straight, all we have to do is vector a particular part of it slightly out, and then immediately the eye organizes the space between those two terms. So if I carry this one out a tiny bit more and then tip it like that on the bridge of the nose, it will alter the character of the space between there and there. And this is what we call the organization of space by form. Now the fact that we can do this visually could be explained by saying, well, in effect we have imported a thing out of the physical body, mass inertia, which we experience when we rush along and find that we can't stop immediately. We tend to carry on in the direction of motion, and therefore we unconsciously carry the attention over in the direction of the line until we come to an object. And being materially orientated, our whole attention is to find an object as a resting point. In all the visual arts we are concerned with organizing space by suggestion of form, the eye being concerned with avoiding material obstacles, is very, very concerned with the tone values and colours of objects, and therefore it is very ready to respond to any suggestion of direction at the visual level which would allow body motion to be conducted without impedance. But there is another kind of space, as one German fellow wrote in a book called Gibt es ein hoher Raum, or is there an auditory space? He noticed that while in the visual arts a line can produce the filling up of a space without actually filling it at all, in the case of music a tone actually fills that space. It does not leave it to your imagination, it actually fills it. And when you are looking at this board, these lines, and you find certain forms there and your interest is held by them in some measure, if you examine yourself you will find what you call attention is going out to the object, and you have to go out and look at it, and then a process of interpretation occurs inside you. And you have to work on it intellectually. And this is very, very important. You have to work on a visual impression intellectually. So we can say that the eye is a symbol of the intellect. So we can say the eye, first person, is also the symbol of the intellect. That an individual, as such, is an intellectual. That the moment you stress your individuality at all, you have stressed your circumscription in the ball of the eye, you have made an object for yourself whereby you know that you are that individual and not another, and at the same time in using this circumscription you have brought to be the possibility of radial moments, and therefore of the development of the diameter and the cross. Then we can start talking about ratio, and we can't talk about ratio until we circumscribe a zone. So when we circumscribe a zone we bring to be the I, the individuality, egotism, the finiting of the observer, and rational activity all at one go. Now you know that the devil's crime is supported by tradition to have been intellectual pride there would correspond exactly with ignoring infinity for whatever reasons, finiting himself, and then proceeding to rationalize his substance on the inside and say, I put myself in order as a finite being, and therefore I do not need any relation with any being outside myself. Now, a being who believes that he doesn't need a relation with any being outside himself is either absolute or self-deceived. If he's absolute, he doesn't need a relation with a being outside himself, because all beings are necessarily inside himself. But if he doesn't believe he's absolute and therefore infinite, he must believe that he is finite. And if he is finite, he must necessarily believe that he needs a relation with externality. Because every finite being that we know, in order to grow from a baby to a grown person, has to absorb energy from inside and push it out to its perimeter. The fact that we have to breathe and have to eat and have to have solar radiation on us and so on to make us grow shows that as finite, circumscribed beings, we are not independent. It is demonstrated that the egotist is deceived when he postulates that he is sufficient for himself as a finite. And if he realizes that he is not a finite, then the question of his relation to beings external to himself takes another form, and instead of being a relation of beings external to himself, it becomes a relation of beings internal to himself as absolute, so that he cannot in any sense escape the relation. Either he is finite and therefore needs external forces to maintain him, or he is absolute and all the bodies that there are internal to him and they are his relational problem within. And not within his finite physical body from which he starts, but within his consciousness. All the bodies in the universe are equally the property of the absolute. And therefore, if a man, say practicing yoga, climbs up and declares himself to be absolute, at that moment he has declared himself absolutely responsible for all the beings internal to absolute space. So whether one is finite or infinite, relations are still one's problem, either because one needs external force to maintain oneself, or because all finite bodies are within one's absolute consciousness. Now in the visual field, we always, as adults, tend to concentrate upon form and to organize space in works of art by vectoring the form, by pointing the form with a definite direction and stress. And in so doing, to create something in nothing. Because from the point of view of the materialist, space is nothing. The man pinned on his visual sense is therefore committed to an abstract analysis of the world in terms of material bodies. Now, if we had no experience other than visual experience, purely, and had never had any experience of tangibles, supposing we'd been born deficient in certain nerve endings, so that we never had a sense of touch or of resistance, the universe would be made up of light, of colours and shades and so on, but there would be no concept within us of a gross material body to stand separately from other bodies. It isn't until we come up against the fact of resistance that we construct the idea of external material bodies. Now, in the interspaces, when we look at the I and an object that is seen, we say in the theory of how we see things, a light shines on an object and is reflected into the eye and stimulates the retina at the back, produces certain processes in the brain which long experience have taught us to interpret as an object outside. this experience involves walking and stretching the arms and touching and so on. But the space in between here is ignored, and a process of intellectual evaluation takes place in interpreting the visual object. And when we come to music, we get something totally different. Instead of interpreting the thing intellectually, we do not find that we have to go out to the object and begin to think about the object. The object, the dynamic tones that come to us, although experienced as in space outside us and coming to us, are in fact felt as pressing in upon us and themselves doing the work. And the peculiar difference between the visual and the hearing experience is that in the visual experience, if I draw two squares, I shade one of them dark and leave the other one, these two things are seen visually and intellectually analysed, so that when I see them I say there is a white square adjacent to a black square. And there is no third resultant. Nothing happens. They don't quarrel. And yes, adjacent. The black one doesn't shout at the white one, and the white one doesn't shout at the black one. All we've had is a perfectly non-emotional experience where certain areas of the retina have been stimulated and intellectual processes of interpretation have been conducted and decided that unequal areas or unequal stimuli of areas of the retina have occurred, the result of the perception of two adjacent squares. But supposing we take two tones in music and we play them next to each other, like C and C sharp. Now, instead of C and C sharp lying side by side, together, without interfering with each other, and leaving it to us to say that is C and C sharp, and no third, instead of that we get interference, dreadful interference called dissonance or discord. And this interference actually occurs not only subjectively in our minds, like some psychologists think, but it also occurs outside the physical body from which we start reference, in the space. Because if we blow a discord on our magical instrument which we've got with us, we will find that if I blow it, I can hear it here, and everyone else in the room will hear it where they are, and if you move about in the room, wherever you move, you will hear this noise, this beautiful discord. And the fact that you can move about in space and that wherever you go these two will still fight each other in that space tells you that the space itself is full of this quarrel between these two tones. So whereas in the visual experience we have an intellectual and unemotional analytic process able to see things separately and produce no resultant of a third order, no quarrel, the moment we introduce musical tones, we start a fight in the substratum which vibrates when those tones are sounded. So that we are then, in the presenting of a musical relation, giving evidence that between the material objects which the intellect separates, the space is not nothing at all. The space between those objects is dynamic. When we look at the word space, we've dealt with this before, we've said the word ace is in it. And the word ace and the word h and the ache all refer to the same ultimate fact of the sentient, self-moving spirit. Space is spirit, and the spirit undulation is positing, that's the P, spirit. It goes along and then goes per. makes this rotation, goes along and does it again. Now this is S and P. Propagating. And every time it rotates, it makes a little point. And the little point is a power, positive zone, in relative motion. Point tells you that there is power in it, and that it is in relative motion. There are forces crossing each other to make it. So the word space means that this undulation goes along, then rotates, and goes on again, and that it is spirit. The word H, and the word H, and the word H, I-H, here, all give you different aspects of the same concept. Spirit itself is aching, and this aching is the cause of its waking up. Exactly the same concept and the same root. Spirit is aching. In terms of Paul's expression, that the whole creation travaileth and groaneth to be delivered from vanity. But not only is creation aching, but spirit itself aches to create, because it said, God so loved the world that he gave his son, etc. He so loved it. Now, a world is an order. Notice the "all" in world again. It is the word tied together, labouring, linking, and so on. Whenever it goes round, it creates a little order, and that little order is a world. And it goes on, it makes another world. And it goes on, it makes another. When we look at the astronomical facts, colossal nebulae, impossible distances. What we are seeing is a great undulation with a zone of rotating force, another undulation, a zone of rotating force, and so on. And each little rotation is a world, and at each point where the rotation begins, there, we have a turning moment. And all that we call moments of time are simply these rotation points which appear as in pulses. We change the N to M before the labial, like P or V. So we say impulse instead of in pulse, simply because P is pronounced on the lip. It is easier to say impulse than in pulse. So there is an impulse because there has been a rotation. And every impulse is what we call a moment of time. Now, throughout infinity, this undulating spirit is passing on and rotating. I've drawn these rotations fairly far apart on here, which would suggest that they're on a long wave frequency. Factually, those are so very, very tiny that I can't draw them on the board without them interfering with each other. And thus it appears that moments of time are adjacent to each other in the world of tangibles. Nevertheless, they still follow this same pattern. Also, the direction of them changes from moment to moment. It's a kind of alternation of direction. Once it goes round clockwise, and the next it goes round widdishing. So there's a continuous reversal of events in every moment. Time itself is also the word emit, and it is emissions of energy that we measure in moments of time. In your nervous system itself, there is an actual release of a definite quantum of energy every moment of perception. If that energy is blocked, it can actually be blocked by psychological tricks and by mechanical tricks. For that period, we won't call it a moment because it isn't turning in this sense. For that period, the being would be unconscious. let us say it would be objectless, because the object is created in the rotation, and as soon as the rotation has occurred, it goes out, and in between there is no thing, there is an undulation, and then there is another. Now, if we look at two ideas that are quite distinct, like democracy and aristocracy, when we consider them, we will always find between the two ideas no idea. And this no idea is not nothing, but it is undulating spirit. And space is that which is between these gross material bodies and that in which the bodies are stored, according to materialistic thinking. But in actual fact, that space between is spirit. So that between every two ideas, there is spirit dynamically moving. Spirit is vectored, spirit is going from one idea to another idea. If we want to make this diagram a little truer, we can make another undulation, turn around the same point and go away, and so on, and see how we associate ideas, and how we free ourselves from an association chain which has a definite direction and therefore inertia, and therefore a tendency to repeat itself. To free ourselves from that by remembering that the space between is no idea at all, and therefore by practicing interspacing, which we've discussed before, interspacing of ideas, we can increase our awareness of the dynamism of space. So if we take an idea like a man with a horse and cart, and we let the man, horse and cart be in the mind, and then we let the man unharness the horse and take it away, leaving the cart alone, and then the man comes back and takes the cart away, and then there is nothing. That no thing which is there is spirit. If you can hold it, instead of allowing objectification, you have the creative origin of all ideas and all things. But if the inertia of your organism and previous activity is too great, you will find that when you try to hold it, another idea will present itself. It will do so precisely because spirit is dynamic. It will not stand still. That will be a state. That will be static. Spirit is dynamic. What you can do with spirit is cause it to dodge in between the ideas. In other words, by practice, you can feel yourself about to make a statement, about to define the situation. Remember that definition and statement is death, is locking up, is finiting, and as soon as you feel yourself about to define, to inhibit the definition, and be on your guard against the next definition which will try to present itself. And as you inhibit this tendency to define, you will discover not that you know less, but that you know more. As you inhibit definitions on the plane of your usual mental life, you will discover there are a lot more ideas above it than you knew about. If you then practice again the interspacing trick, you will discover there are more ideas above that. And you will unconsciously be changing your frequency. If you concentrate on the gross material body, one you can touch, then your frequency is the lowest that you can have. If you concentrate on the idea about it in your mind, the frequency has gone up. If you concentrate on the emotional relationship between two, it goes up higher still. If you concentrate on the rational statement that all these things are necessarily functions of the superspace, which is spirit, pure dynamism, then the whole of your intellectual life is lifted up to a new level. And if you then place yourself in the field, absolute, you will experience an emotional, intellectual, dual experience of form and feeling simultaneously, in which all the bodies will be co-presented in one moment. That is, you will see the universe itself turn with all constituent parts within it in that one moment. Now, just in order to remind ourselves and make sure that we can understand this fact, that the tones do not behave in the same way that visual images do. We'll blow a note on here. And the thing is to notice that when we blow on here, the thing comes to you and you do not have any intellectual object upon which to pin yourself. When I did the drawing of the man's profile here, you referred to something in your memory, a category of beings called men, as interpreted with pencils. And that was an intellectual act. Now, if I blow a note on here, you will find that there is no intellectual process, no spontaneous attempt to find out anything about it intellectually, but the thing itself comes to you, you feel it to be outside your physical body in its origin. You can actually locate it in the dark with your eyes closed if you want. So it definitely has spatial existence. But at the same time, it's coming to you through moments. That means impulses, emissions of energy. It is beating the medium between this instrument and you in a definite manner. If I play this C here, you hear there something, but your intellect is in abeyance. And you all feel that, in fact, you do not think about that in the way that you have to think to interpret a square visually. Now, we said that when I did the two squares visually, the white and the black, you saw them as a white and black square and nothing else happened. They didn't fight. The retina itself is so arranged that adjacent parts of it are stimulated and in some measure insulated from the motions of the other parts. But when we put two tones together, which are all right separately, they are not all right together. Now, either of those tones in isolation is all right, but if I put both together, then a quarrel begins. And if you listen very carefully, you will find the quarrel is not your quarrel, but it's a quarrel between the tones. I say this because certain psychologists have actually suggested that the dynamism of musical tones is subjective, meaning belonging to the individual only, and not a matter of the tones. Now, if you listen very carefully, you will find that the quarrel is between the tones themselves. Quarrel is not entirely your own handiwork. It is a genuine quarrel between the two tones. Also, when I blow one of these, if we walk around the room, we will hear it in any place in the room. And so we can say that that tone is filling all the space in the room. The space in the room, therefore, must be dynamically beating out that tone. If we then play another one in the same place, this tone will fight in the same places as the other tone, only because of a different character of the two tones. And from the acoustical point of view, the difference is a difference of frequency, which means if the frequencies are too close, they will be trying to move dynamic space in the place where they are in contrary directions simultaneously. And that will be the cause of the quarrel. As if you were to try to move your hand up and down simultaneously. Remember, your physical body is only a behavior of space, where space, remembering the ace in it, equals pure dynamism, initiative, power, or spirit. Now, if we play two notes that are far enough apart, we find that they do not quarrel in the same way that they do when they're close together. Here's a fifth. You had another note there, I think, as well as those two, which was a resultant one. It shows you another funny thing about this dynamic space. that when the two tones are beating together in the same place, they can beat up between them another vibration, the result of the two. And this is totally different from the visual experience of space. Now, because of this peculiar factor about tones, philosophers, from Pythagoras and earlier than that, he's an example of a man whose fragments have survived. Philosophers of that kind have suggested that music is somehow heavenly, celestial. We know that in all the great religions, music has been used from the very beginning to induce emotional states, non-intellectual states, that emotion is not an intellectually perceived thing, that music is not intellectually perceived, and therefore music is a method of shifting you out of your devilish, analytical, rationalizing centers. Hence it's used by the church. Now, there is another peculiar fact, that the tones, when considered not acoustically but musically, are dynamic in the sense that they are trying to go somewhere. If we consider tone acoustically, we are considering the thing simply as a phenomenon of vibration, frequency. But when we consider it musically, we are concerned with the direction in which it apparently wants to move. So if I play two notes here, which is a seventh, the seventh one is shouting out for the octave. You will hear it. You see, you get an immediate sensation that this is right, when if I play a note, then the seventh, and then put the octave in and take the seventh out, as the seventh disappears, you will feel, now it is all right. Now, this phenomenon of the octave has been called by musical theorists the miracle of the octave, because the octave is not musically different. That is, its dynamism is exactly the same. I take the note called the fifth and play that. That fifth demands the tonic, and that tonic is the tone, the unity principle of the scale, the T1 principle of the scale. So when we play the fifth, it demands either an octave up there or down there. It doesn't matter whether it goes up or down. So we say the peculiar character about the fifth in the octave is that it will move either up or down to the tonic. And it doesn't care. That means that the tonic is not important as up or down, but as unity principle. There's something very, very peculiar about musical tones. They are not just frequencies. They are frequencies which, when played together in certain ways, shout out for what we call resolutions. They shout out for returns to unity. We take a concept, a tone, we introduce another note into it. And when we introduce this note, you will hear a sort of threatening sound. Now, as soon as the... when I've heard it F sharp, that it's threatened. So this isn't quite right. And the reason it isn't quite right is because the relation of the individual being constitutes a peculiar pattern of tones. Every particle inside our body is vibrating at a definite frequency. You know that on a tape recorder with various speeds, we can produce Mickey Mouse effects by recording at a slow speed and playing back at a double speed. Supposing we get two recorders and we record a note, and then we keep doubling it up higher and higher and higher and higher, we will still have the same dynamism within it, but we can push the thing up till it goes out of audio frequencies. It will still be there, but we will not be able to hear it because the ear will be too coarse. But if we push this back below the atomic level down to primary motions, we will actually be at the level at which, if we could hear it, then we would be experiencing the constituent vibrations of subatomic impulses in our own bodies. Now, a human being has got a lot of parts. Each part is vibrating in its own peculiar way. If we take the smallest part, and therefore the smallest vibration in a human being, and we count those up in the body, there'll be a very, very great number. But because of the grouping of these things, the subatomic parts give rise to atoms, these give rise to molecules, and these to proteins and organic structures and so on, all of which are compounds of this fundamental frequency. And each time we put a group of frequencies together, we are really lowering the note. So in that sense, we can say that if we draw a circle for top C, we could draw another circle with three circles inside it and say that is another C lower down, and then take a group of those and draw another C. We'd always have a circular form, but inside there'd always be a great number of these impulses, and we could say cut the impulses in half each time and thus show that the octave is always half the vibration in the lower octave than it is above, or you double in the higher to the one below. This means that inside the human being there are in fact sounding simultaneously complex structures, either concordant or discordant. This leads to the possibility of a religious significance and a therapeutic significance in music. Musical tone is dynamism, that means say it is pointing. You know that Socrates complained about the behaviour of certain Greek musical modes. Certain modes, that is scales, have certain emotional effects and they can cause lassitude. Another mode will cause sensuality. Another mode will cause a desire to go to war and so on. And these are non-intellectual experiences, they're simply emotional responses. And it means that the tones of those moods are, in effect, causing resonances within the very structure of the being itself. Supposing I play this triad here, this is C, E, and G. Now that feels quite comfortable and quite familiar. We've heard it up in there. If I now play the third one, a semitone lower, which gives us the minor, we feel immediately a little bit sad. Now, we haven't made an intellectual judgment. We're not that clever. We haven't counted the frequencies intellectually and said to ourselves, well, I don't like the number of beats per second on that E-flat relative to the E-natural. We're not that good at mathematics. So we are not doing it intellectually. The thing is doing itself, and we are being subjected to it. Now, if we lower it again and play in terms of minor third, play a second, I'll go down from the third, you'll see a quarrel, but at the same time a kind of relief that sadness has gone, because you're going to have to do something about the discord that results. Go down from that minor third into the second. Can you hear that? There's not only a fight, but a promise that we might get home after all. Now, supposing we say the tonic note is the one that gives the unit to the scale, which is the one that we will return to at the end of the piece. That's our unity principle. We play it. We move away from it. Now, as soon as we play that second tone, we hear what we can call a direction implication, a dynamism. It wants to do something else. So if we play then the third, it sounds what we would call right. Now again, certain psychologists are trying to suggest it sounds right because we've heard it so often. And there is, in some degree, a possibility of that. But it isn't the whole truth. Because within itself, there are certain frequency relations that are requiring a return to the tonic. So if we play the tonic, and then the second, and then the third, and then back again, we'll feel what we would call a completion. So we feel that we've been away from home and come back again. Now this going away from home and coming back again is the basis of all that we call tonal music. This being at home, home is ho me, behold myself, the only place where I can get my own way. And then going away from it is already to advance towards possible danger. I've left home, immediately discord, and I've left the territory on which I can dictate. I climb out, find a temporary resting place, which is not quite right. I'll go a bit further to before. Well, that's not right either. I come to the fifth. I've still got to get back somehow. I can go up to the octave, to the sixth and seventh. Now, this is a very important thing because when we talk about tonality, about this principle of unity, we are talking about something in us which we need tremendously. We need unity. And if the unity we've got is only a temporary unity, it can be broken and it will be broken at some time. Now, supposing we talk for a moment that C was the only proper tonic, the only unity principle on the scale. And supposing somebody came along and said to us while we were trying to do it, that is not the true principle of the tonic, but D is. And started to prove it by going. Now he's got a unity out of D. That's no good us standing on C as essential unity, because the same ratio between the notes exists if we start on D. So anything can stand as a basis of unity, quite legitimately, but the unity of one thing is no ground for criticizing the unity basis of another thing. We can say that every scale, every ladder standing on a tonic is valid in and for itself, but its validity does not invalidate the tonal base of other beings. Now we've talked about the unique nature of individuals before and said that spirit makes everything unique, and this ties up again with spirit and music, because in music any tone, whatever, can stand as a unity base. And providing we keep the same ratio between the successive notes, we will get exactly the same effect in internal dynamism. And no matter how many scales we play, it will never invalidate another scale. Supposing somebody said, well, there are only seven notes really repeating, so there are only seven scales. Another man would say, well, there are semitones. We can start Neither on sea or deep, we shall on sea sharp if we want. And the summary said, all right, so we've got 13 in an octave of semitones, 12 and the octave. Well, a man can say, well, we've got quarter tones. In between C and C sharp, there's another tone. We can start on that one. And in between those two, we've got eighth tones and sixteenth tones and so on. And then we'll start moving down to a fundamental of the high frequency, the short wave. And we will come down to the other frequency, which is the fundamental from which all the other scales are built up. In other words, we have a frequency universe with an aleph beat, which is the fastest one we can get, and then we can take a group of such beats and allow that to constitute a larger wave, and therefore a lower note, and treat that note as a tonic and build a scale upon it. And this we can do arbitrarily, but no matter how much we do it, we can never invalidate the use of another scale. So, if we want, as individuals, that is, as tonic bases, to be valid, we can never use our individuality as a ground for disallowing the individuality of another. And as all these different individualities are merely groupings of the absolute, the aleph frequency, then the man who claims to be moving towards absolute consciousness is moving towards this other frequency, which is the top ground frequency, groupings of which constitute the separate individualities of other beings. So that he actually becomes responsible, that is, able to respond to all the needs of all those other beings who are finite because group. The more he knows, the more sensitive he becomes, the greater his ability to respond to these patterns of frequencies, the greater is his responsibility for them. So we can never go like some of the German supermen misinterpreting Nietzsche and say that if I become more sensitive than you, you are no good. Because to become more sensitive is to move away from the long wave, low frequencies, towards the short wave, high frequency base. And all the long wave structures are merely compounds of these fundamental beats. And increase of sensitivity is simply increase of the awareness of the dependency of larger groups of frequencies, or low notes, upon higher ones. And once it is seen that the lower ones are dependent upon the higher, then the higher must remember that the lower are dependent upon it. And therefore the increase of responsibility with the increase of sensitivity. Now, we've only just come out of the 19th century, about 59 years, and in the 19th century, atomism, materialism, was the rule. And in that period, men were taught by so-called scientists, which means men crucified on the visual impression, that matter really existed in its own right. And that nature was simply a structure of material bodies, and that all these bodies were very busy, fortuitously crashing into each other, and that by a strange piece of illogicality, nature was red in fang and claw. These blind, fortuitously moving little ball bearings somehow were equipped with destructive appetites and fangs and claws. They imported a psychological significance into a purely materialistic point of view, which is quite invalid. Now, in 1926, in the Cambridge experiments, when the atom was exploded, then materialism became anachronistic, not only theoretically, but in practice. And there gradually arose, from that period, more and more consideration for space instead of body.
Einstein had already begun to think about the space-time as a continuum, in other words, to give equal validity to time and space, and to make space-time a sort of unity in his unifield theory, so that space no longer became simply that in which you store the commodities when you've got a big business, but it actually was a dynamic substance itself. And here we would have to reinterpret the word substance means superstance, because it is fundamentally spirit. And it is this space-time which, by the emissions of the energy of the spatial substance, the ace spirit substance, produces the time process. And in Einstein's unifield, the curvature of space is related to bodies within that space. Curvature increases in relation with certain bodies in space. We think of our undulation process and then rotation, undulation, rotation. We can see that whenever there is a body, there must be an increase of curvature. Once we have said that space is spirit, and that it is only a false orientation to focus with your eye on what would be tangibly experienced if you walked up to it, and pretend that that is reality, and to ignore all the dynamism between you and it, because it isn't tangible at the gross level, once we have done that, we've cut ourselves off from the possibility of advancing in power control and movement towards the absolute. It was because atomism had failed in the pursuit of power that men began to knock on the atom. They were pursuing power. They went down like Cain did into the earth, and they thought, in the earth is power. So they collected the earth. That was their maker, their mother, their material. And then they beat on it and did manipulations with it, and suddenly it blew up in their face and disappeared. It refuted them. In the act of blowing up in that way, it revealed itself to be no more than compactions of force. And suddenly the universe, instead of being a material universe, became a dynamic field, and matter became no more than a little vortical spin. And compared with the colossal undulations, the little rotations occupy very, very little space. So really, there's very, very little matter in reality compared with spirit. The matter is just a little rotations, and between the rotations, the space is colossal. Thus, if you take the space in the atom, it is far in excess of the diameter of an electron or of a proton. If we take the solar system as one structure, the distance from the Earth, 93 million miles to the Sun, is considerably greater than the 8,000 miles diameter of the Earth. The solar system is almost entirely space. But that space is not nothing. And today's science knows that that space is dynamic. That between the Sun and the Earth, that is not the cold, dead void that they printed in the textbooks of 20 years ago, already anachronistic, of course, but that instead of being cold and dead, it is highly alive, charged with dangerous radiations, which you have to put your hat on. And they now realize that the whole concept of voidity, of vacuum, of emptiness, was a construct made through focusing on the tangibles in order to avoid damaging your gross material center of reference. Because the thing that makes the baby careful is pain. When it tumbles and bangs itself, it learns to distinguish between falling on the bed, which is nice, and falling on the brass knob at the end of the bed, which is nasty. And this painful experience causes it to distinguish between bodies hard or dangerous and bodies soft, not dangerous. So that in order to preserve itself, it has been forced into materialism, into the hard, gross matter. And that's for the baby to preserve itself. When it's grown up, and it has learned to circumvent these zones of high pressure that it calls material bodies, then it is time for it to rethink the situation. Having preserved its vehicle of reference, its physical body, then it should refine that preserved vehicle of reference and no longer bother to worship the material negatively through fear, but to examine the dynamic nature of the space between bodies. And this can be done by increasing your awareness of space and the motions in space. Thus, if you sit next to somebody in a bus or a train, and instead of looking at the man's shoes and the pearl out of the corner of your eyes, if you compare the temperature of the man to begin with the lady on the right, by closing your eyes and just feeling that, you will discover that he's got a heat all around. Now, it's still a very material thing, but it is slightly more sensitive than detecting the gross material body. Now, if you then look at the space around that man's body, look at it with your physical eyes, you will discover little vertical spins of dust particles caused by the heat of his body. It doesn't need a lot of practice to do that, actually. Actually see the spinning of the air. And if the sunlight is at the appropriate angle, you will see it very, very easily. If you get in an artificial light like this, at certain angles in relation to certain objects, you will find that you can see it very easily. Once you've seen the dust particles, don't focus on them, but try and look between them, and you will discover that you can see lights dodging about in between the dust particles. And then you will become aware that the space is becoming surcharged, and you will have to remind yourself that it was so before you started looking at it, otherwise it will make you nervous. You naturally find that space is full of energies, and that you can see those with your physical eyes. Now, you know that the embryo echoes the development of the human race in broad outline from its earliest time. And in growing up through the state of childhood into the state of adulthood, it passes through earlier phases of perceptive level. And the child, before it has learned to focus on a gross material object, and it's still in its mother's arms and doesn't have to preserve itself, it is at the stage at which our ancestors were a long, long time ago, when they didn't distinguish gross material bodies as such. And they never banged themselves because, like the bat flying to a room with strings across it, doesn't touch them. They were so sensitive that they never banged themselves because they could feel the presence of that body like a congenitally blind person can. This means that the child actually has, we've all had as children, this experience. It's not something we will discover that we've never had before. It's something that when we regain it, we will remember that we've done it before. And in the process, we have taken a step towards this higher sensitivity of seeing the essential dynamism of space. Now, the moment you've got this dynamism of space firmly fixed in you, and the concept that a material body is only a rotation of a motion in this space, and the moment you take the focusing of the rotation onto the field, you are in a continuum, and a continuum has no part. And therefore all the bodies in that continuum are equally yours, if you are identified with the continuum. Therefore your responsibility to all those bodies is the same. And furthermore, your capacity for acting upon those beings is the same. At the absolute level, in other words, you can say, as Christ said, I and my Father are one. That absolute, that ace in space, is the Father. The sun is the first big rotation, the macrocosmic self. The little rotations inside it are us. If, instead of identifying with the little rotation of my individuality, I identify with the macrocosmic one, I'm identifying with Christ as the macrocosmic logos. If I identify with the Father, or that, the space itself, then I'm identified with the Father. And when Christ says that we should be one together as he is one with us and he is one with the Father, we in him and he in the Father, and so on, it is all a statement about the dynamism of space and the absolute